Welcome to Press Start, how to become a game developer. I'm Adam Ardisa Smita, CEO of Arsanesia and Vice President of Indonesia Game Association, will be your host for this episode. In this podcast, we will talk about game development and how to start your career as a game developer. We will invite experts from the game industry to tell us their game development journey to inspire us. I hope this podcast can help you to start to be a game developer. And don't forget to stay tuned, because Press Start will have a new episode every week on Thursday. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by Indonesia Game Association and the Goethe Institute Jakarta. So today we are having a special guest from Germany. I think I met with him the first time in 2017 when I visited Safladen. We have Lorenzo Filia. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for coming into this podcast. It's really nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, right now, in which city are you in?
I'm in Berlin, Germany.
All right, you're in Berlin. And how's the situation regarding pandemic over there?
I would say, compared to many other parts of the world, I think it's going relatively well. So good amount of people got vaccinated. I mean, I would say that pretty much everyone who wanted to get the vaccine by now got vaccinated.
Wow.
And I think at this stage now, when we're recording at the end of August, and I would say things are fairly normal with the restrictions, but So I think, definitely, I think we're in the category where we can't complain. So
everybody already go back to the normal activity, like going to work, go to the park, something like that?
The park, I would say, going outdoors, going to parks, eating outside, it's allowed, it's fairly normal. Regarding indoors, there are some restrictions. People need to wear a mask indoors, and But overall, yes, I think the mask is the only requirement. And
I see. That's nice. All right. Before we started our discussion, maybe could you please give us some quick introduction regarding yourself, like where are you working now and what's your role in the game industry? Go ahead.
Yeah, so currently my main role is that of executive producer for the indie game studio Maschine & Mensch. We've been working now for some time on a game called Curious Expedition 2, which is a roguelike expedition simulation set in the late 19th century. And it's out already on Steam, and it was released very recently on Switch, and it will be out on PlayStation and Xbox pretty soon.
Ooh.
And and we're working currently, even though the game is out, the version 1.0, we're working on some future content updates. And that's currently my main activity. And alongside this, I also work as outreach manager for Codex, which is a project management tool aimed specifically at game developers. And these are for the past couple of years, these have been my this is what I've been keeping me mostly busy. In the past before pandemic, I was also active as an event organizer. I did for a few years between 2014 and 2019. I worked as program manager for Amaze, an independent game festival here in Berlin, which is quite known with in different parts of the world. And that's also, I know also you visited in 2017. You were part of it, and alongside this, I also organizing together with a few other people. I organize every couple of months a meetup for the local game dev community called Talk and Play. We did 40 editions of this event every 2 months on the course of 7 years. Now it's on a break because of the pandemic, But yeah, we're kind of planning to resume hopefully at some point in the future. And yeah, the last editions we did of this event were quite successful. It's a free event, but it was attracting 200 people at each edition. So yeah, it's an event where people could meet, network, exchange ideas, show their projects and so on. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. We're gonna dig deeper with that role in the later on, like your role as a producer, your role as the outreach, and then all the events that you manage. But before we start the question, we usually give all of our guests on Press Start some trivial question. So you don't need to worry. There is no right or wrong, and there's no score or leaderboard. It's only some simple question, but you can answer with everything pop up in your head right away. Ready?
Okay. Yeah.
All right. What is the first question? What is the last game that you played?
I'm waiting too long. It's a bad memory for this stuff. I would say, Death Trash, actually, the last play.
Death argument. Trash, I Death see. Trash. It recently released, like, right?
It was very recently released, and it's made by a member of our co-working space and indie game collective, Zaftladen, where I'm sitting right now. This is not my flat. This is not my sofa. It's some of the sofas we have in the office. So yeah, the Trash was released 2-3 weeks ago in early access, and Stefan, the developer, is our friend. I bought it immediately on Steam just to leave a review. I only got to play a bit like through the first part, but yes, Death Trash.
Yes, that is awesome. I saw the review from the media, and the performance on Steam is very, very good. I hope the games will be very successful.
Yeah, so far, okay. I think it's been doing well so far, yeah.
Yes, yes. All right, so for the second question, what is the longest hour for a game that you ever played, the game that you play the most, that you keep playing, or you spend a lot of time for playing that games?
I would say now on top of my head, I mean, I would need to check. I mean, on Steam, I would have the data. I would say from time to time, I get hooked on some mobile game, and then it just tends to be the game I go back to just because... there are games I go back to just because they're available on my phone. Does it count the games I've worked on?
Of course that counts. That's a game.
Then I would say between like playing myself and the testing and testing the consoles, I would say Curious Expedition 2. Definitely okay. in recent times. But that's a bit cheating. I guess it's not the question you like to hear. I need to let me go back to that maybe later. I'll think about it, and I can open Steam in the background and check a bit my history. But to be honest, I have there are games from time to time where I get hooked on and play a lot. But generally speaking, I'm more the type of person I would rather like play more games for like more games, but for a shorter time than spend hundreds of hours on a game.
Do you have any particular genre of the game that you like the most? Like maybe some RPGs or some narrative games?
Yeah, I would say I tended more to lead towards the be interested in like narrative games, so shorter, like 1-3 hours long. I tend to like to experience games in a way more similar to how you experience like books or movies, you know, like start and an end. And I think also as I get older, yeah, I tend to prefer those type of experiences rather than continuous ones where I put hundreds of hours in. So yeah,
I see. That's interesting, right? All right. Okay, for the next question, what is the most memorable game event that you ever attended or organized?
Oh, well, I won't talk about the ones I organized or been involved in. I mean, I have a lot of good memories regarding the events I've been involved, of course. Amaze, there's been a lot of good editions. I would say the last one where I was involved and the last one that took place physically before the pandemic was in 2019 here in Berlin, took place in a former sports center. sport, basically kind of like not a gym, but it's a place where you can play different type of sports. Uh-huh. And is that kind of in the eastern part of Berlin? It was kind of a semi, I wouldn't say abandoned, but really not longer in use. And uh-huh. and we kind of occupied the entire building, and it was quite. I have some good memories about that event. Maybe also because again, it was one of the last big events I went to, and then I would say maybe once I went, I organized myself. I was thinking recently, rethinking recently about Playful Arts Festival, an event organized was organized in the Netherlands for a few years by my friend Zuraida Butter, and she's also the she's currently actually she did the program curator for Amaze. So she kind of after I left Amaze, she kind of took the she's basically filling the role I used to do. And this event, like Playful Arts Festival, used to take place in the beginning of the summer in the Netherlands, and in an event which took place all over a city in the Netherlands. So it was like a lot of activities, open air. It was somehow between performance, theater, games. There was a bit of digital games, but a lot of like physical games in the city. It was interacting with buildings and with people, and it was very inspiring. I mean, I really enjoy walking around, discovering cities, and doing this in a playful way. It was quite unique. I would say it's unlike any other event I've been to. So yeah, and I have really good memories of this.
That's interesting.
Yeah, playful arts.
Arts. Oh, nice. What month usually the events help?
It's usually in June. I think the last edition was in June. Unfortunately, now I think they don't have reliable budgeting. So I think now the game, I wouldn't say it's canceled, but it's on at least it's on a break. I think if maybe they will get budget at some point in the future, they will do it again. But it was a very hybrid event. So, but yeah, definitely recommend it. At least I think you can find online definitely some documentation. So I would recommend checking it out.
Of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, and the last question. What subject that you learn from school that you think is very useful in your career in the game industry?
That's one. That's an easy one. I can answer you immediately, and that's English. That's was my favorite, I would say. Even though I still speak English with an Italian accent, it was by far my favorite subject at school. And it really allowed me, you know, I was always fascinated about like other languages and cultures, and I wanted to spend some time living abroad, even when I was young. And of course, like being able to speak English decently allowed me to work abroad and to live abroad. So it was very useful. Wow. So yeah, definitely.
That is very nice. Okay, so it will connect with our discussion for today. So this podcast we will talk about your journey in the video game industry, and most of our audience is new or maybe just want to start to jump in the industry, and maybe your story can inspire all of the audience regarding the career in the game development. So for starter, what I like to ask is, like, do you remember when was the first time that you want to work in the game industry, and what is the trigger that make you want to work in the game industry?
So my path into games industry, and I would say the first time I thought, okay, this is very interesting, I think it would have been around 10 years ago, so around 2011. So I used to play, I mean, bit of background story, I used to play games as a kid. As a young kid, I was really into video games as a kid. And but then when I would say from when I was like 13, 14 until my late 20s, I lost interest in games because I discovered most of the internet. I mean, I got, you know, World Wide Web and making websites, meeting people online, and I got into music, design, other type of things. And video games is something I didn't really follow for quite some time, for a good part of the late 90s and for the entire 2000s. Mm-hmm. And then what happened in around 2011 is that I got my first, let's say, touchscreen device. It wasn't a smartphone, but it was a touchscreen device. I think an old iPod Touch. And the pre, you know, is kind of the iPhone without the phone, right? It was this type of device. I'm not sure they do anymore. And I got this device because I could see, you know, smartphones were starting to become a thing. And people were talking about apps and, you know, touchscreen devices. And I felt, okay, you know, I might get the cheapest device of this type, so I can check a bit how the interface looks like, what apps look like, you know, how this whole system works, you know. But it was more, at the time, I think I was more interested. My idea was more, I will do some research into applications, apps in general, user interface, the type of thing, user interaction. And then what happened, you know, I was checking a bit of the App Store, and while I was browsing apps, I saw, oh, there's some games as well, right? And then I downloaded some touchscreen iOS games, and I think I was just like searching. I was Googling, okay, games, best games for iPod Touch, whatever, and that's when I discovered basically there was a thing called indie games.
Okay.
And that's how I discovered, oh, there's a thing called indie games. And I was very familiar with the concept of indie music, you know, independent music. But I never heard, to be honest, the term indie game or indie game developer, you know. And that fascinated me as somebody who was into independent music. I said, okay, that's, you know, you have independent musicians, you can also have independent game developers. That's interesting, you know, the idea of somebody doing their own things and not having games made by huge big studios or big corporations. And so that's basically how I got into indie games. And shortly after then, I attended the first edition of Amaze Festival here in Berlin. I just attended as a spectator. And I liked the event so much that I really got inspired, and I decided, okay, I want to get involved somehow in games. And that's how I started collaborating with Amaze, and that's how I started also to organize my own events. At the beginning, I was really thinking, okay, what can I do? How can I contribute to the game scene, to the indie game scene somehow? You know, what can I bring to the table? And I wasn't particularly interested in making games myself, but I've always been more of a facilitator, I would say. And so I thought, okay, one thing I could do is maybe organize a meetup, help organizing some events, some game jams, other things here in Berlin. And that's basically how my journey into games started. And then, yeah, I don't know if you want to consider doing events already working in the game industry or in game development, but that's the first thing I did. And then just by meeting, networking, and meeting, becoming friends with so many game developers here in Berlin, eventually I got the opportunity to collaborate with Machine and Mensch, which is what I'm doing now.
I see. Do you live in Berlin from the start, or you moved to Berlin at some point?
I've been living in Berlin for 13 years now, all my journey into game development and the game scene has been here in Berlin. So yeah, when I got interested, I was already living in Berlin. So that's also why, even though I'm originally from Italy, I'm familiar a bit. I know a bit what's going on in Italy with the game scene, within the game scene. But I've never been active in the game scene while I was in Italy. So somehow I'm a bit detached. So I'm more involved, and I'm much more knowledge here of the scene in Germany and in Berlin than I have in Italy.
Did you move to Berlin because of, like, you saw the Amaze and like, I want to be part of it and I want to move? Or you already in Berlin and you met this awesome event?
No, I moved to Berlin before games. So I moved in 2008, and I moved to Berlin initially. The first thing, I know it's not very romantic, but the first thing that caught my attention about Berlin was was how cheap it was back then. I mean, for being a major Western city capital in Western Europe, it was fairly cheap to live and offered a good quality of life. And I like what was going on, and and it just ended up being very lucky timing, because even though Berlin was cheap and interesting for a long time, it didn't provide many employment opportunities. And around the time I moved here in 2008, it's when the startup internet tech scene started growing with startups like such as SoundCloud primarily, and then other ones which followed. So this meant there were much more opportunities for employment for people with a kind of background similar to mine. So yeah,
I see. And then when you move to Berlin, and then you saw this event, and how do you start to jump into the industry? Did you contact with the organizer of Amaze and you told them that, hey, I want to be part of it, I want to work for you, or how do you start it?
Yeah, I met the festival director, the founder of Amaze, is called Thorsten S. Wiedemann, and at the very first edition of the festival where I attended as a spectator, which was in 2012, yes, I believe. I just briefly congratulated him. I went to introduce myself just to say, hey, I really like the event. Mm. And then maybe I said something like, yeah, I would like to help in the future. I'm not sure. But then basically we were in touch, I think, on online, on social media, on Twitter. And eventually the following year, the festival grew a little bit and he offered me to help. The very first year, I worked with Amaze in 2013. I did some social media. So I was just basically doing some, let's say, live tweeting, taking pictures and things like that. And was my first contact. So yeah, with the event. Yeah.
I see. So is it like a full-time position or something that is part-time, or?
You mean with Amaze?
Yes, with Amaze.
With Amaze, well, I'm no longer involved right now. I did from 2013 to 2019, and it was always a part-time kind of thing. Usually, I would say I would start getting. My role was. For the first edition of 2013, I did a bit of social media, as I mentioned, and after that, basically, my role became program manager, which meant I was. Curating the program part regarding the talks and a bit the workshop. So basically, together with Thorsten, we would pick the speakers, the artists that we wanted to put on stage or to do workshops. We would maybe decide topics, you know. Sometimes we discuss with the speakers, sometimes we would suggest topics or put together panels. So all the day program, basically, the program you'd have during the day on stage. And yeah, and basically, usually this for me would throughout the entire year. Whenever I met somebody in person or online, or I saw somebody was doing something interesting, I would take note. I would write down their name and some notes, and then a few months before the festival, we would start getting started with the planning. You know, we really sit down and say, usually 6 months in advance, we would sit down and say, okay, who do we want to invite this year, and we'll try to put together a bit of a short list. And then send in the invitation, see who was available and interested in coming over to Berlin, and then put together the schedule. Who do we put first? Who do we put on stage? At what time? If we have multiple stages, who do we put at the same time? And stuff like that. So, yeah.
Well, usually, what kind of topic that is being talked in Amaze Fest? Is it more like the technical side, business side, or maybe more generic?
It really varies, but overall, Amaze is really, I think the full name of Amaze right now, it's like Independent Games and Playful Media Festival. Mm. And it's been moving, it's always been interested in more in this, I would say more, you can say experimental side of game making, experimental, artistic, and non-commercial. There've been exceptions, you know, I mean, it also changed over time as also the indie game scene changed and became a bit more commercialized. Also, the event itself it changed a little bit, you know, the focus. And I would say in general, the topic would be more more in terms of like inspiration and like where the inspiration for the games came from. It would rarely be like technical. It would be maybe like some stuff, maybe a little bit of business, but very, very little on the technical aspect. So yeah, it would more be to be, again, as I said, like it was a matter of like the inspiration for the game developers, but also that kind of talks which will be inspirational for the audience or provide ideas, new thoughts, reflections, and start a conversation and things like that.
I see. And you've started in Amaze by being a spectator, and you meet the organizer, you build network with them, and then you get invited to be part of the program manager. And after that, what drive you to create your own events, like the one that you talk and play that you mentioned?
Talk and play, yes. Yep. It's been a few years now. It's been 8 years. Let me think chronologically. Chronologically, actually, I think I went, what happened is like, I went to the first Amaze as a spectator in 2012. Then a few months later, I started, I organized the first two editions of Talk and Play, the event, the meetup. I started at the very beginning on my own. And then I think after that, I did the first edition of Amaze social media. But basically, by the time I became the program manager for Amaze, I had at least 1 year and a half, 1 year of experience doing my own small events. Oh, so I was, right. I got some experience into contacting speakers, deciding the topic, helping, like writing down the description of the talk, structuring a bit like a small event, putting one talk next to each other. So I had a little bit of experience, and I think that's what motivated like Thorsten to give me a possibility, an opportunity. That's why Thorsten then offered me this role, because he saw I was doing this on a small scale, and he offered me to do it on a bigger scale with the festival, with the Amaze. So I would say, for the years we were together, I would say like definitely Amaze and myself, we grew at the same time. You know, it was like parallel growth. As the festival grew, also my experience and my knowledge and stuff grew as well. So it was a very nice, I think, like very positive experience for both of us, for the festival and for myself, for sure.
If Amaze Festival is more like a big event, like a whole week with a lot of things going on and with this scale like quite big, and how about Talk and Play? Is it something as big as Amaze, or this is something like in a whole week or something like that, or is something more regular?
So Amaze is a regular meetup taking place every 2 months. So usually there's like 6 editions.
Talk and Play?
Talk and Play. It's taking place every couple of months, mm-hmm. So usually 6 editions per year. And it takes place on one evening during the week, usually on a Tuesday evening. So starting, doors opening at 7 p.m. and lasting around 4 hours, so until 11 p.m. or shortly before midnight. And it's quite compact, but usually basically the event would be split in 2 parts. It's called Talk and Play because it's the 2 parts, like the talk part, which is like the first half of the event where there is like some short presentations on stage. It could be like maybe 2-3 very short talks, 5-10 minutes each, or it could be one longer presentation around half an hour, and followed by some game pitches, so people could pitch their game on stage very quickly, introduce their game, and then followed by a section where we had the announcements from the community. So everyone, I mean, usually they would have to give us a heads up in advance, but the stage would be open for like 5-10 minutes for anyone who wanted to come on stage and make an announcement. For example, hey, we want to promote this game jam organizing, or hey, there is this opportunity of collaborations, or hey, I'm looking for a 3D artist for my new prototype, if anyone wants to help me. It could be any type of announcement, really. And this format, I mean, we did 40 editions of this event every 2 months, pretty much. And over the years, we really optimized the event. So also the way this the first part of the event was structured, it was really refining, iterating on each edition. So how to have the different structure of the event. So it was quite compact, but very effective. So the stage part, the talk part would be around 1 hour long, but there would be a lot going on. And then the second part of the evening would start, called like the play part. And this is where anyone could showcase games or projects they were working on, and which means we would provide around 20 tables and chairs. 20 tables around on the venue. That's how many we could fit, and basically people, again, that ideally to pre-register in advance so we could prepare, but basically there would be people could just, you know, put their laptop or console, some would bring a monitor, they would bring their own setup, their hardware, and then like set up the game very quickly, and then basically for around for a couple of hours you could go from table to table, play games which were maybe could be like some in prototype stage, some maybe released, some soon to be released, some already came out. There would be like mostly digital games, mobile, desktop or console previews, but there would also be card games. There would be sometimes maybe somebody made a book or a thing which was not, they were presenting something which was not like a playable thing, but usually it would be like games. And basically the audience could go, just go around the venue, talk with people making the games, asking them questions, try the things out and give feedback. And this was very, I think it worked, the format again, it was, went through a lot of iterations, but it worked out really well because it was, I think, kind of like, how can I say, it was a win-win situation. It was very, there was value for the attendees because you could play games, preview in development, or you could play games and meet the creators, but it would also be valuable for the people showcasing the games because they could either get early playtest feedback, they could do promote the game to the local people, they could find collaborators, inspiration. It was really like a sort of, it worked really well because all the parts, everybody got something out of it. And during the second part of the evening, of course, people were not forced to play the games. They could also just like watch, or they could just like, a lot of people just decided to network, to talk, you know. During the second part of the evening, people would just like chat. If there was nice weather, they could go outside, but it would be just people having having a drink and talking with everyone. And and this event, Talk and Play, for the last few years, for the last couple of years, attracted around 200 attendees. So the entry has always been free entry. I'm happy to be proven wrong, but to my knowledge, is the biggest biggest regular meetup, game dev meetup, regular one happening. It's the biggest of its kind. So I did a bit of research, you know, there were like similar events. I think in Canada there was some stuff. It used to be in Montreal. I think in Vancouver there was something. But when I looked up, I think no one was like the type of size. You know, like to do every two events, a free every 2 months, a free event, which for 200 attendees, it's quite something. And I think it has to do. We were able to do an event of this size and for free, largely because Berlin still allows this to happen. You know, in Berlin is still possible somehow. It's getting more and more difficult, it's getting more and more expensive, but it's still possible to find venues, nice venues in central locations, which can be rented for cheap. And in our case, we used to do the event at a venue which doesn't exist anymore, which is called the Game Science Center. And when we did the event there, we did it for free. So we had an agreement with the owners that basically we could use the space for free. So basically they would keep the money from the bar. So anyone who bought a drink, you know, the venue kept the money. But for us, we could use the space, we could use the technology they would provide. And it was perfect. So it was like, it was a nice... It was nice for them because it would bring people to the venue and they would find out about the space. And it was good for us because we could use a very nice space in central Berlin for free.
I see. You managed to make a great community, great events, attract like hundreds of attendees, attract like more than like around 20 studios to showcase their games, the speakers. My question is like, how did you start it from someone who nobody knows, you don't have any relation until you can get this many people to come to the event? How do you start it and grow the communities and event?
Yeah, it's a good event. Let's see if I can say something useful for other people who might be listening. And I would say, first of all, the token play when I started organizing at the very beginning on my own. Now, as it grew, I have a main co-organizer, Masha Camino, who's also my colleague here at the Machine Mensch. She's a game designer. And for the last 3 years, she's been the co-organizer of the event with me. But at the very beginning, it was pretty much on my own. But I would say it wasn't the very first event ever organized, because I had a bit of experience from when I was still living in Italy. I had some experience organizing small music shows. So I knew kind of the basic of what it takes to, you know, let's say book a space, rent a space, and promote the event, bring people there. Of course, it's different when you're promoting a music show than it's different than promoting a tech a game development meetup. But there are some similarities. You know, at the end of the day, I think it's also about making the people feel comfortable. I mean, communicating the event well, let people understand what it's happening, what is going to happen, and then I always try to make the event, I would say, entertaining, you know, for participants. But I would say my background, so there was a bit of this event concert organizational background, and also my background was also in project management. So when I started organizing Talk and Play on my own in 2013, I was working back then for some startups here, not in games, but from some tech startups as a project manager.
Oh, okay.
And I think, I always say, you know, organizing events is a bit like project management. I think it's project management on steroids. It's like project management with, like, you're working on an event. It's like an event is... When you do an event, you have a very hard, solid deadline. You know, if you're working on a game and we say, okay, we're releasing on the 1st of September, if there are delays, it's not nice. But if you're really in a bad place, you can still say, okay, sorry, but we need to postpone the release, right?
Yep, yep.
And with an event, usually if you start promoting, if you say the event is happening on the 1st of September, technically, you can cancel it, but usually it's going to happen on that event, no matter what, and then you work in order to make it happen, right? And so basically for me, I approach really events also as a project management also task, you know? So it meant, okay, I need to do an event. What do I need? It's like, okay, breaking down in different parts. So I need to do the promotion. So I need a logo, I need a website, I need a description, I need a form to sign up, I need a system. I need a map to how to reach the venue, and then what do I need? I need to contact the speakers. And if I want to advertise the speakers for the event 2 weeks in advance, I need to confirm them at least 3 weeks in advance. Then I will need to factor the time I need for them to provide me a biography. Again, I will really structuring, I think that's why I say, you know, events at the end. I would say it's not rocket science, but events, it's a ton of small, very small tasks, you know, and they all need to come together. So you need to have a bit of some organization. You need to be able to make everything work together. Especially if you want to do events of a certain level, of a certain quality, I think you need to have also some eye for detail, you know, and basically that's how I started. And then again, my project management background also contributed, because I was aware when I started doing Talk and Play, I was aware of how much time I had available, which was not much. I mean, I was working full time this project management job. And so one of the very first early decisions, which then became, I think, also part of the success of Talk and Play, one of the first decisions was to decide not to do the event monthly. Which is a very common decision. I wouldn't call it a mistake, but it's a very common decision first-time organizers do. But I decided to do it every 2 months, because basically I had done a bit of research with other type of like other tech meetups happening in Berlin, and I saw there were a lot of them. You know, for a lot of events, it was normal to say, well, yeah, you know, once a month sounds right. You know, like you do it every month, it's regular. But what I noticed is that a lot of events, after a few months, they quickly run out of like speakers or quality speakers, you know, like, because finding people every month, it's quite tricky, you know. At the beginning, when you start, everybody wants to give a talk, but then it becomes more tricky and difficult to find interested and interesting people to put in front of a microphone. And so I realized, okay, if I do the event every couple of months, every 2 months, it's much more sustainable. It gives me more time to curate it, to promote it. And I was also like, you know, and then if it proves successful, I can still increase the frequency, you know. I think, I believe it's always, I always recommend, you know, first-time organizers to start like less frequently. And then if it's successful, if you feel like, if you have team, support, money, whatever, you can, can go more frequent. It's better to go from an event every 2 months happening once a month than the opposite, you know. If you start an event and you do it very frequent and then you change the frequency, you extend it, it confuses people. And I think it's very important also for an event to happen on a regular basis. So, you know, to be really constant and to happen no matter what on a regular basis. It can be 1, 2, 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, once a year, but it's very important. And yeah, so basically I started doing the event on my own on a small scale, and then little by little it grew, and I tried with every edition, I tried to iterate, to try things out, to experiment with formats, what worked, what didn't work, to see also what was more valuable for the audience, but also try to listen a bit to my gut instinct, also which direction I want to bring it, and also which kind of projects I wanted to highlight, and so on. So yeah,
I see. Like you mentioned, like this is doing the thing that you did, that you do to manage the event. There's a lot of things that you need to prepare, from the speakers, managing the public publication, and you need to build the community. And you can doing it even though 2 months. I think it's still quite a lot of work to do. And besides, you already had your full-time job, so this is more like voluntarily you do for the community. Like in Indonesia, we have some communities, but their challenge always in the consistency, like how to keep doing it while they also have their full-time job. So my question is, what motivates you to keep doing this every 2 months, even though this is like a lot of work? And I mean, like, this is not your full-time job.
Yeah, it's another good question, I guess. But you also, I mean, you've also been organizing events, right? Yeah, I think so. You know, okay, that's why you're asking this question, because I guess you know where it's coming from. Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I had times, several times where you know, this became a bit too much. You know, there've been, you know, periods where okay, I had deadlines at work, but still I had to, you know, pack everything quickly to go to the venue and prepare for the event. You know, whenever I could afford it, maybe I would take half day off or try to leave a bit early work. But sometimes it was just a busy week at work and I couldn't take holidays just to organize the event. Right. So there've been evenings when it's been very, there've been days, times when it was a bit like stressful. Yeah, I tried, you know, to not to burn out, to take care of a bit of myself. But I think something we did, I did a few times, was, for example, take a summer break. So usually, even though it was every 2 months, maybe a few years, we skipped the summer. We did, so maybe we did 5 editions, so we wouldn't do it in June or July or August. We would skip a bit. Also because people prefer to be outdoors during those those months. And also one thing that helped at some point, you know, when I was maybe considering maybe taking a break or stopping the event, or something which helped, was on a personal level, it helped to maybe keep the event, try new things out, you know, to change a bit the format of the event, try some different things, spicing it up somehow. And that kept it a bit interesting for me. So I didn't feel like I was always just doing the same thing over and over. And another thing that helped a lot for sure was then at some point deciding to get more people involved as co-organizers. So as I mentioned already, primarily Masha Camino, but also then other people with a team. We had a very fruitful collaboration with a school here, a private school, which is a game design program. The school is called University of Applied Sciences Europe, EU. Mm. And we had a very fruitful collaborations with them. I was very good friend with the head of the department, of the game department. And then they would also promote the event at the school, and we would have a lot of people, students helping out at the event. So this was also like, as we got more people helping, and as I got older also, and I tried to become and learn to be a better organizer, I also learned how to delegate, you know, more and to give more tasks to other people. And, you know, of course, it's always, I started the event, I felt it was my baby, but it was also like, you know, I cannot, if I want the event to grow, I need to be able also to have other people contribute and do their own thing and just to trust them. And I was very lucky to find a lot of people, also a lot of these students were really very talented and very skilled and smart people. And then I tried also to give them ownership, you know, to make it feel like it wasn't, oh, it's my event and you're helping out, but you know, it's the event. Masha and myself are primarily organizing, but it wouldn't happen at this scale without everyone working together, you know, so.
Yes, that's awesome. And in your opinion, what is the impact of these events that you doing all the time to the community and the game industry ecosystem around Berlin?
But I think this, you should, I mean, it would be a better question asked to somebody else. I would have to say, I don't know, I think definitely, I would say, you know, thanks to, I mean, Berlin itself has just been attracting so many people in the last, I mean, years and like decades, you know, since the fall of the wall. But in the last 10, 15 years in particular, I would say Berlin has been going through a lot of growth, you know. So just Berlin became a city where a lot of people in Europe wanted to move to. And at the same time, specifically in the game scene, like an event like Amaze allowed, you know, which brought people from all over the world here once a year, also provided opportunity for people to discover Berlin. And I know a lot of people who came to Amaze from other parts of Europe or the world, and then they really love the city and the vibe, and then they decided to move to the city, you know, to try to move here. And I think an event like Talk and Play, which is aimed mostly at the local community, I think still... still contributed, like I believe it helped with the growth of the indie game scene, you know, having just a place with every 2 months where people can exchange ideas, knowledge, employment opportunities is hugely valuable, you know, having something like regular happening like that, it's really important, you know, there's something, I think like events in general, bringing people together, gathering people, it's an incredibly powerful thing, you know. And there is maybe a small excursus. There is this book I recommend to anyone interested in organizing events or events or gathering people. It's called The Art of Gathering. It's a recent book, just came out, I think 3-4 years ago by Priya Parker. And this book, talks about different type of events, different types of gathering, you know, from commercial conferences to just like dinner parties to all type of events. And he's analyzing and he's talking about these events. But the very first thing he says on the first page to describe the power of gathering, of bringing together, is saying how, if you think about it, if you look into it, whenever a country starts going towards more... a restrictive regime, a dictatorship kind of thing, one of the first rights people lose is the right of assembly, the right of getting together in the same physical space. And this gives you, she makes a point where like, well, this gives you an idea of how powerful it is. You know, governments know well how powerful it is when people, even small groups of people, come together and exchange ideas. This can change the world, you know? And I don't think when we do a game development event, we're not changing the world, but still, you know, I'm just saying it's very powerful. You have this type of interactions between people, and it's something, it's hard to replace, and which is unfortunate now. You know, as much as I love, you know, the internet and digital opportunities, when it comes to events, it's, you cannot replicate everything that happens in a physical, in real life event. I mean, at the same time, the internet allows us to talk now, me and you, to have a nice conversation from two different continents, you know? So yeah, I'm not complaining, but it's just like different things. And yeah.
True, I agree with that. There's some kind like, maybe like some chemistry or sparks that did not happen if we do not meet real offline, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. So my next question is, after so long that you're like more in facilitator and giving like in the support role in the game industry, while your full time job is more like not in the game industry, what makes you decided to work in the game studio?
So yeah, I mean, I've been active, you know, with Talk and Play, with Amaze for a bunch of years, and people would often ask me, "So why, when are you gonna work on your own game? When are you gonna work on a game?" You know, and yeah, and I don't know. I was always, my response was always, "Well, I would do it when the I would consider doing if the right opportunity comes across. You know, if the right project with the right people, and yeah, if it's also a good contract, either like, you know, full time or like or decently paid, you know, if it happens, you know, I will do it." But I was never in the position to be like, okay, I want to work in games no matter what, so I'm gonna accept any type of job, you know. I was really I was like kind of patient, or I was like, you know, I'm happy doing events and other things, and if the right opportunity comes along, then I would be happy too. And then, yeah, and eventually the right opportunity came. I think in 2018, I was already sharing the office space with, I mentioned earlier, maybe we can talk maybe later or not, but we have this co-working space and indie game collective called Saftladen here in Berlin. And I was already sharing this space with some other studios. One of them was Machine and Mensch, the studio behind the Curse Expedition. And then basically what happened, I was already there with my desk doing my own projects. And then when Machine and Mensch started working on the sequel on Curious Expedition 2, and they had like some funding, that support from a publisher, they asked me, I was like sitting nearby, and they just asked me, "Hey, would you be interested in working with us?" And then, you know, I really liked Johannes and Riyad, the two founders of the studio. And I liked the game, so it just felt right. So it was a good... this is the kind of like opportunity I was waiting for and hoping for. And then, was kind of a very nice opportunity to be able to work on a new game from scratch, from day one, and on a commercial game, to see it like from the very beginning to shipping. And so I'm happy I'm part of this journey now.
Awesome, awesome. And your role is a executive producer. Can you tell us a little bit about what kind of role is that, and what you do daily usually?
Yeah, so I mean, now it's executive producer. Until very recently, it was just like simply producer. But now I changed the role because right now we're looking for a proper producer. So usually, you know, the job of producer, I mean, you know, job titles at companies, especially tech companies or smaller studios, they can mean different things, you know. And producer, I know a lot of producers for indie game studios, and this can vary a lot, right? So when we're talking about producer, often it's very similar, the job, to that of a project manager. So basically it's like planning the tasks, checking the budget, making sure everything gets delivered on time, on budget, and without people working overtime and so on, right? So it's really, again, it's like, I would say it's project management, basically. And with small indie studios, and specifically with Machine and Mensch, what happened is like, when I was asked to join, I was asked, okay, we kind of, I wouldn't say we designed the position around my experience, but it was like, it felt, okay, you get hired as a producer, the official title, and then what exactly you will end up doing on a day-to-day, we will see as we start the project, and then as we both get a feeling of each other, right? And being a very small team, you know, with like two developers, two artists, one animator, external sound designers, I would say the project management part during the production of the game was quite limited. You know, we're only working on this project, and so kinda, for the most part, the developers, the game designers, they could manage and plan their own work. You know, there wasn't a strong need of an external project manager. And at the same time, I also started taking care of like other types of tasks for the studio. You know, I basically my job became that of like as I describe it these days is my job. I take care of a lot of different tasks in the studio, smaller tasks which are necessary for a studio to operate, in order to allow the rest of the team to actually make the games, right? Which means the actual development of the game. So this means, for example, I took over a lot of tasks from the founders, you know, from Jonas and Riyad, primarily when it comes to communication, to marketing, to managing the store pages, the sales of the games, and but also when it comes to, okay, we need to hire somebody, a new person, let's put up a job online, let's collect all the applications, let's contact the applicants. Also the type of thing, you know, it's a small studio, we don't have an HR division, so I also take care of the type of things. But also if there's a new opportunity, it is a new store, there's a new platform, or there's an opportunity, or if we need to apply with the games for an award to submit the game, they're all very small things, but they add up, you know, and they can be very distracting, you know. And I think I want to allow the entire team, but specifically also Johannes and Ria, the founders of the studio, to as much as possible that they can still work and make the games, you know. They still need to do, of course, they're the founders, they still need to do some, take care of like paperwork, some other like management stuff, and but I try to take over a lot of these different type of things. So yeah, that's a bit what I am right now. So my executive producer role now, it's a mix of a lot of different things, as I mentioned, so yeah.
Do you think this role is... can be filled by someone new, like a fresh grad or someone who want to start their career in game industry? Or do you think this is the role that you need experience to be able to work on this role?
Well, yeah, it depends. I guess I find, you know, the fact that I'm a certain age. I mean, I'm almost, I'm turning 40 next year, and in my life I had a lot of experience, you know, work as project manager, I work as graphic designer, I did events, I did a lot of different things, you know, and I think at some point the different set of skills I have, they all come together in they form a unique mix, you know, and I think this is very valuable for the job I do now, because, you know, I don't know, let me make an example. If you have to submit the game for an award and they require certain assets, visual assets and stuff, I can, you know, I don't need to bother any artist or anyone else. I can put together the files myself, or you know, also if you need to prepare the assets for like Steam page, I can, you know, do the stuff in Photoshop. If it comes down to doing interviewing some candidates, or like writing a job ad, writing newsletters, or putting together, yeah, this type of things, I can do it on my own. It's, in a way, I'm because I have enough experience, work experience, I'm also confident enough that I know I can do it on my own. So it really depends. I think, you know, I think you can be like relatively young and have already made like different experiences. It depends. I think it pays off. You need to be, for being in general, like a producer, project manager, or this type of thing, it helps a lot. You need to be very curious and you need to be okay with surely multitasking, but also jumping from one task to the other, but also being interested in different aspects, you know. I know there's people who really like, you know, they have a kind of like calling life or very focused on one aspect, like let's say coding or sound design or technical art, you know, or animation, and they really want to be focused only on doing that thing and nothing else. They want to become very good at that, and I respect that. And there's other people like me, I'm more like curious, I want to know more how this works, how that works, how these things come together. So for me, working on a lot of different things, it's more like it's what keeps me going and motivated rather than stressful. I mean, sometimes it's stressing me, but okay, that's I'm learning to deal with that. But I would say you can be, to answer your question, I think you could also be in a producer role. you could start. Of course, it helps. Ideally, I think it's tricky. I know I've spoken with other people, other studios, and you know, when you want to hire a producer or project manager, if it's somebody very junior, somebody who never worked on anything, you kind of, it means they will learn on your job, and that can be a bit tricky, you know, because you cannot, some studios cannot afford, you know, the time or the mistakes. So, so I think it can be, this type of role, maybe it helps if you already maybe work in also in some other position in a company, you know, if you've seen some of the what happens, how a project is delivered, you know, is like produced, is made from the beginning to the end. That being said, I would also, in some cases, you know, if it's very promising candidate and it's somebody maybe who only work game jams, or maybe somebody who shipped their own game on itch.io, you know, even like smaller games, but it's somebody who can prove, well, I made all different parts of this game. I know a bit like the production. I know how Unity, or I know how this engine works. I know how these different elements come together. I think still, you know, it really depends on the person. They can be the candidate, the young candidate, with less experience, but you can see the enthusiasm and the curiosity and the willingness, you know, to learn and feel this type of shows. Yeah.
I see. That's interesting. And I think one last question, because we run out of the time. So for more general view, not only a role in producer, but every role in the game industry, in your experience, you're managing community, you saw a lot of new people jumping into the industry. What tips that you can give to everyone that who want to start in the game industry?
I would always say very simply, I would suggest to very generically do stuff, do stuff and put it out there. Doing stuff can mean, you know, if you like to draw, do art, draw it, take a picture and put it online, put it on Twitter, on Instagram, publish it somewhere, put it on your website. And, if you like making games, if you want to make games, go to game jams, you know, you can go, there's a lot of game jams online. So depending on which part of the world you live, there are also like physical game jams happening on site. And if you make these games, you know, no matter how small, no matter if you made them in like 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, one weekend, whatever, no matter if it's rough, just put it online, I always recommend it. I mean, my favorite platform for this type of stuff is itch.io. Mm-hmm. itch.io, I think, is the best platform. It's free, it's very easy, it's very fast to set up. And I would recommend, you know, you do a project and you put it out there. And whatever you like, you know, if you like to do in music, sound, try to collaborate with other games and basically do stuff and then document it and put it out there somewhere. And I think that's the biggest issue, you know, if you're just getting started in the industry, you're trying to get your first job, for example, you have to put yourself in the shoes of the person evaluating your profile, your application, and they need to see something, you know. And you know, if we're hiring for a junior candidate and we say, okay, no experience or very little experience required, you know, we don't expect you to have shipped 10 games, you know, and that's okay, but we want to see something, you know. So that means, you know, the more stuff you do, the better you get at it. Then you document it, you put it, you show it to us. And so I would say when it comes to games, my simple answer would be like create your own itch.io profile. You can put all the projects you worked on. Itch.io also allows you to put projects you collaborated on. So there's a feature where like a project can be shown on different pages. It's not like it used to be different in the past, but now if me and you, we made a game in a game jam, then we can publish it both, the same project on both pages, both profiles. Okay. And do stuff. And the thing is also like, and something I've learned that comes from my life experience as an older man, it's things happen always when you do stuff, you know? You do something, and so everything you do, it's a consequence of something else you've done. So you do one thing and then something else happens, you know? I used to give like some talks at schools here, and once I put together for one conversation with students, I remember I put together kind of a list of all the steps that took me to do that day. You know, I was like, I'm sitting in front of you because I met your the head of the game department at your school, and I met him because of organizing this event, and I organized this event because I was doing other events, and I was like, it's like everything is a consequence of something else. You know, you do something and then you meet people, you do something, you learn something, you do something, and then you learn what you're good at, you learn what you don't like doing, and yeah, it always brings you. But the more you do, the more things happen. And when I say doing things, also it's very important, it doesn't have to be perfect, it doesn't have to be big, you know? And when it comes to games, I still often see younger people, they're like, okay, I want to do this game, the first game, I want to do something big. And I always like, you know, it's hard to scope games, to find, to scope, to decide how long it will take to make something, a game, even if you're very experienced. And on top of that, you know, smaller games, I think if you do a very small game which takes 3 minutes, I'm gonna play it from start to end. Mm-hmm. If you make a game which is 3 hours long, probably I won't have the time, you know. So there's also an advantage to making like smaller experiences, smaller games, you know, at least non-commercially. Commercially is a different aspect, but like if you're trying to build up your portfolio, do a lot of different things and put them out there.
I see. I really like the quote, do stuff, put it out there. I think that's really, really important thing for everyone who listen to this podcast.
You can use it as a claim for the promotion if you want. do stuff. You can put a balloon. Do stuff.
Thank you, Lorenzo, for your time. It's really nice having you.
Thanks for having me.
Everyone, that's it for today. I hope this session can give you insight and courage to press start your career as a game developer. I'm Adam Arisa Smita. Keep playing games, start making games. Bye-bye. Thank you, Lorenzo.
Thank you. Bye-bye.